I'm very excited about my guest today. He's one of the people that started us really looking back at least four decades ago. Paul Ehrlich is going to be on. But before I talk about that, since we're on the subject of water with the last report from Ecuador, I want to tell you about a day-long conference on water, sacred and profane, this Saturday. That's this Saturday, March 6th, at the Nevada City United Methodist Church. According to conference organizers, they say water is sacred, essential for all life. That's true. Used as a sacrament in various religions, it is an expression of our divine love, but now Earth's waters are being profaned. Our premise is that water should be held in trust for the common good and not monopolized, privatized, or sold as a commodity. Access to water is a basic human right of all living things. During the conference, participants will celebrate Earth's sacred waters through presentation, through shared discussion, Native American drumming, song, film, and ritual. Regional and local speakers will highlight the growing scarcity of fresh water, water rights, people movements to defend water, and the need to preserve water for humans and living things for all generations. Water, sacred and profaned, is being sponsored by Earth Justice Ministries, Church and Society Committee of Nevada City, Grass Valley, United Methodist Church, Unitarian Universalist Church, and Peace and Social Justice Committee, and Grass Valley Friends Meeting, Pax Christi of Nevada City. Admission is voluntary. Donations, $0 to $25. For information, go to www.earth-justice.org. To register, go to water@earth-justice.org or call 274-1320. So that's about the water. Now, I also want to thank all of you for listening, of course, and thank you, Sacramento Natural Foods Co-op, for presenting the class Sugar, Sugar Everywhere, Cut Your Craving Without Feeling Deprived, wherein participants learn simple and powerful nutrient-based ways to stop sugar cravings. That's Wednesday, March 24th at 6:30 p.m. Complete schedule at sacfoodcoop.com. So I'm just very thrilled to have Paul Ehrlich on the show today. He is a Bing Professor of Population Studies and Professor of Biological Science at Stanford University. He's an expert in the fields of evolution, ecology, and human biology. His book 40-some years ago, The Population Bomb, was a wake-up call to all of us. He's been tirelessly working since then. I think he's written over 40 books, including The Betrayal of Science and Reason and his latest book, The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, which he co-authored with his wife, Anne, who unfortunately won't be. I was hoping she was going to be here, but she will not be here today. So welcome to Conversations, Paul.
It's great to be here, and Anne wishes she could be here, but she's got the local upper respiratory infection.
Yeah. It's going around.
I was going to say, I hardly recognize my friends when they're not coughing anymore.
Yeah. You know, a big part of your book is looking at the humanity's rise to dominance and the result, and how it's a result of both genetic and cultural evolution. Can you just start out by talking a little bit about how you see that, the coming together of genetic and cultural evolution in looking at our rise to dominance as a human species?
Well, first of all, it depends on where you start, but you can start right back when an extraterrestrial event wiped out the dinosaurs and opened up opportunities for mammals about 65 million years ago. And gradually, small mammals, some of them started going up into the trees and bushes to hunt for insects. And they're our ancestors. There are little things like tarsiers. Many of you know tarsiers. And it's really important that we went up into the trees and bushes because for two reasons. One is, if you'll recall, natural selection is being able to out-reproduce your buddies. And when you're in the trees and leaping from limb to limb, those that are trying to smell where the next limb is tend to end up dead on the forest floor, and those that have the visual system that lets them see where the next limb is do much better. And so we became sight animals, which has a lot to do with, for instance, some of our prejudices today, why we focus so much on a very variable and basically unimportant characteristic like skin color. And also, at snatching insects, we used our fingers. And other things that live in the trees, like squirrels, have claws. And if you try and think of, you know, building a civilization, running a computer with claws, it doesn't work very well. So we started out in the right direction, and gradually became smarter and smarter for reasons that are somewhat controversial, and eventually developed a language with syntax, which is probably our single most important characteristic, and that allowed us to develop a huge body of non-genetic information. You know, our genetic information is stored largely in the form of DNA, but we have infinitely more cultural information. And it's our ability to manipulate that and change cultures which has taken us to our position of dominance. Unfortunately, there's a paradox, because we're extremely smart and extremely dominant, and we're using our smartness and dominance to destroy our own life support systems, which in turn is not very clever.
Seems like we are also extremely dumb in a lot of ways right now, given what you call the human predicament in your book. And
Go ahead.
I was going to just say, let's trace a little bit about how we came to dominate. Now, we had a show 2 weeks ago. We talked about a lot of the issues around population, but I love how you get underneath it into the cultural and genetic way that we evolved and interact and co-created this place that we're in now. Can you just begin to lay out how we rose to dominance?
Yeah, I mean, we got to be very smart, and there's a lot of controversy still about what was the key thing in the evolution of the great apes that made us such a special ape. Right now, some people think it's primarily that we became bipedal, and that is walking on two legs, which freed our hands to do other things. There's a wonderful book by Sarah Blaffer Hurdy, HRDY, called Mothers and Others, which claims that the big advantage with us is that we became cooperative breeders, unlike any of the other great apes, like some monkeys. But that, I years ago spent time at Gombe Stream with the chimpanzees. If you watch a chimp mother, she guards her offspring very, very, very carefully, doesn't let other females near, doesn't let males near the offspring, because they're likely to eat it. And so chimps are raised basically as a mother-offspring pair, whereas human beings, our young are shared. For instance, there's wet nursing in human beings. The mothers will actually let other females nurse their children, and our children are designed evolutionarily to attract caregivers. And the way we've done so well is not by having a single female basically raise our offspring, but by having a group of caregivers do it. And you can see this, for instance, in the way our children imitate what we do. From a very, very early age, humans are designed to be attracted to other people and form social bonds and be empathetic with others. And it's been a very effective strategy for getting along well in the world and for eventually developing the technologies that allow us to control a lot of the world.
What part has the role of the development of language had in that?
Absolutely crucial, because, you know, chimps have culture. There are different groups of chimps, for instance, have different ways of hunting and so on. That's all passed on by imitation, basically. For instance, some people say, well, are chimps ethical animals? Chimps can't be ethical animals, because ethics are agreed upon modes of behavior. If you don't have language with syntax, you can't agree on anything. It's very important that we learn to communicate with language. And by the way, all human languages are equally sophisticated. There are no primitive human languages and no advanced ones. They all can handle the whole mess. And then, of course, when we added printing on top of it, that allowed us not only to pass on detailed information with language, but allowed us to do it between generations, to make records, to build. You know, we weren't dependent on one individual learning everything, then trying to pass it on and dying. You could pass it on in written form. So that the invention of writing was a second level of really important cultural development. And since then, of course, we've gone to radio, TV, computers, all other lots of forms of communication. And this has had an interesting and really stunning and important effect that most people don't recognize. And it's occurred in just the mostly in the last 10,000 years, and the vast majority of that in the last couple hundred. And that's the development of what I like to call a culture gap. I used to live for a while with the Inuit, with the Eskimos, when I was a kid. Not that much of a kid, but when I was in my 20s. And every Eskimo knew the entire culture, basically, of their group. That is, the men knew how to use an ulu, a woman's knife. They didn't ordinarily do it. The women knew how to hunt a seal on the ice, although they didn't ordinarily do it. But they all of them basically had all the genetic information of their group. Now, the average person in our country doesn't have 1/1,000,000th of the, I hope I said non-genetic information. That is the cultural information.
Right.
Now, neither you nor I have 1/1,000,000th of the cultural education, cultural information of our group. For instance, if I handed you the pieces of a desktop computer, you couldn't reassemble the computer. You couldn't tell me where the pieces came from, how they were made, and so on, and I couldn't either. That is, each of us has only very, very narrow bits of our culture.
Wondering how we would even, short of a chip implant or something, be able to hold that amount, the vast amount of information,
of
cultural information.
We can't. It's embodied in our artifacts and in our libraries and in our computer disks and so on. But what this means, for example, that you have senators trying to make decisions on climate change when they don't know the first tiny little bit about how the climate works or how the world works. Most of our legislators have no scientific background. Science is at least half of our culture, probably more, science and technology. And yet the decisions that are critical to all of us are being made by people who are on the other side of a vast culture gap. And that's one of the things that I and my colleagues think has to be changed. That is, we can't all know everything. But everybody ought to know how the Congress works, and everybody ought to know the difference between climate disruption and ozone depletion, for example. And we don't teach it at Stanford. You can get all the way through Stanford without being able to give a coherent description of why the scientific community is worried sick about climate disruption and why there's a very highly paid campaign to make it look like it's not happening by people who have a financial interest in continuing on the route we're on.
It amazes me. We had the author, James Hogan, of Climate Cover-Up recently, and it just amazes me that people can be so far out of touch with their own relationship to the natural world. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the reciprocal relationship between evolution-environment interaction and how that works, and specifically how we have managed to get so far removed, and of course in the long run, how are we going to bring ourselves back to deal with this human predicament or great crisis that we're in?
Well, one of our problems has been, and it's something that interests me and some of my colleagues a great deal, is the different rates at which different parts of our culture evolve. And I think, again, just like the climate, the basic facts are not all that complicated. You can even see them almost automatically. For example, if Plato came back today, thousands of years after he lived, and I showed him my desktop computer that I'm sitting in front of now, he would be stunned and amazed, and he'd have no clue how it works. And even if the letters appeared in Greek and so on, to him it would be very nearly a miracle, because of course that was back in the days when if you wanted to pass on something in writing, it had to be hand-scribed. I mean, remember during the Middle Ages, monasteries, one of their main activities was copying documents. It was before printing. And he wouldn't understand airplanes, and he wouldn't understand how our buildings are put together, what automobiles did, and so on. And the technological side, he would be essentially like a baby. Obviously, somebody as bright as Plato would learn very rapidly, but the world would be a stunning, dazzling place to him, because our artifacts, our technologies, have evolved so rapidly, particularly in the last few hundred years. In other words, if he appeared, say, in England in 1400, things wouldn't have been all that different. But in the last few hundred years, things have really changed. But if we started talking about ethics, how we treat each other, how we deal with criminals, how we organize our society, who should vote, and so on and so forth, he'd have different ideas, but he'd be right in the discussion. In other words, our ethical side of our culture has evolved very, very slowly compared to the technological side. And that gives us a terrible gap, because our capabilities of doing things have increased enormously, but our thinking about how we should treat each other and our life support systems hasn't evolved very much at all in those thousands of years. And so it creates a very difficult problem for us. We're a small group animal struggling for the very first time in our history to live in gigantic groups. We're evolutionarily designed to be able to recognize and deal with about 150 other people, plus or minus. And we're trying to live in groups of billions. And that really stresses us.
I was in Copenhagen and about to go to Bolivia soon for the climate conference, and that really showed up, trying to get people from such huge different cultures and different, particularly in the areas of the richer and the poorer countries. The split was so vast. I just left there shaking my head and thinking, how are we going to get ourselves out of this mess?
Yeah, it's a very common reaction, and wise.
You know, one of the things you talk about, and if you just tuned in, I'm talking to Paul Ehrlich and about his new book, The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. And one of the things that you talk about in there is how some organisms adjust to environmental change while others don't, or there's a different pace to it. And, you know, when you look at the human species, of course, we have the ability to move and build things to shelter. But it seems like in this case, we're moving way too slow for what's coming at us. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, we're certainly moving much too slow for what's coming at us. The huge advantage we have, of course, is that, I mean, in straight evolutionary terms, the thing that gives you the best advantage, if you're talking about genetic evolution, is short generation time. That's why we're always having to fight the bacteria that are becoming resistant to our antibiotics, the bugs that are becoming resistant to our pesticides, and so on. We don't have short generation time, but we have substituted this incredible ability to evolve our culture. But we haven't thought enough about it. We haven't thought about it in those terms. And we've allowed the ethical side, if you want to put it that way, to lag way behind the technological side. I mean, for example, we're having huge discussions now about what automobile mileages should be. We aren't having huge discussions about what human beings are for. I mean, have we been wise in designing our societies around automobiles instead of around people? Is what people in the United States want is more junk all the time, forever, always more junk? Or do we want to have more leisure time to smell the flowers and make love? We don't have the ethical discussions of how we treat each other and our environment. And that is, I think, if not the major, a major problem with our dilemma. And of course we have, I hate to say this, huge problems now with the media and the sources of information that that people have access to.
Yeah, it's a common thing that we talk about on this show.
Yeah, well, sure you do, because you're trying to keep a sort of a broad discussion going. But sadly, virtually anybody can find now a media channel, be it on the web or somewhere else, that will simply support their prejudices and never make them fire a synapse in terms of thinking. I was appalled. The Wall Street Journal, which you may have heard of, when Norman Borlaug, who got the Nobel Prize for the Green Revolution, saved a lot of people's lives back about, that was 1970, I think he got the prize. He died a few months ago, and I knew him slightly, and his niece is a very close friend of Anne's and mine. And I was asked to write an obituary of him. And about that time, the Wall Street Journal came out with an article and said, well, Norman Borlaug was the person that showed that population wasn't important, that Ehrlich was wrong, and saved everybody's lives and solved the problem of starvation. Of course, this is a newspaper that is supposed to have somebody on it who can read. There are more people starving today than there were when Norman got the Nobel Prize. B, in his Nobel Prize speech, Norman said, the only way we're going to ultimately solve this problem is to get the people who are concerned about population and food together, because all I've done is maybe bought us a few decades to solve the population monster. And he belonged to population control organizations and so on. Yet, reading the Wall Street Journal, you'd never know any of that. Most people don't know that more than a billion people are hungry today. And that's sad. I mean, where do you now go to get, outside of NPR and a few other places, even the so-called newspaper of record, the New York Times, now publishes a lot of gibbering nonsense, and nobody seems to know it.
Right. We've got the industry pretty much owned by five corporations. And, you know, let's take all these barriers here, Paul, that we've got to having a global ethic emerge and look at this problem from the perspective of the unexamined belief of our separateness, the massive unconsciousness of people only concerned about making money, and the barriers that we've got to communication through language and worldview and assumptions. Where do we go? How do we get this conversation for a global ethic? Because, you know, the whole issue, of course, of climate debt and climate reparation, which, you know, is an issue that was trying to be brought up in Copenhagen, but was pretty much pushed under the table. But it is a huge issue that, for instance, holds two worldviews very much apart. How do we enter this conversation and get it going? I think you've been doing some work with your MAHB site that you've been working on.
Scientists that I know, and it's a very large number of them, are all, these are environmental scientists, are all basically convinced of one thing, and that is the fundamentals of what direction we're going and what's wrong with it are very clear to the scientific community. They have been published by the scientific community in great detail. There are, for example, as far as I know, no environmental scientists who think we should continue burning fossil fuels the way we are now. Certainly no biologists who think that skin color tells you something about a person's honesty or brains and so on. And yet, we continue to act as if none of these things had happened, that the scholarly community had never said anything about these things. And we think the basic problem is we've got to change human behavior. And so we started a few years ago a thing called the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, the basic idea of which is to get a bottom-up discussion going, with some top-down, but mostly bottom-up discussion of what people are for, what the limits to how many people we can have at various lifestyles, and what we choose to do and how we get towards a sustainable society. If you're interested, you can get connected by going to http://MAHB, that's Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, but it's just MAHB.stanford.edu. And what we're doing is trying to, you know, Al Gore put out a really good movie on climate change. Probably many of your listeners have seen it. It was technically almost perfect, but the list of suggestions of what to do at the end were not what's needed. In other words, it said things like unplug your cell phone when you're not using it. Well, if you unplug your cell phone where you're not using it, each year you'll save about the amount of energy that's required to start your car once. In other words, it's a brick in the toilet tank type of solution, a tiny incremental thing when we need dramatic change. The kinds of things we need to be discussing are, for example, if capitalism requires continual growth of the physical economy or the population, then capitalism is doomed. It's that simple. Anybody who doesn't have to take off their shoes to count up to 20 knows that. It's not, you know, where do you hear a discussion, for example, of that we can't continue to keep consuming to try more and more to try and solve our economic problems?
On conversations every week.
Yeah, right. I mean, so,
but very few places.
It's exactly so. The mob is trying to get the discussions going on the really critical things, like can we start moving much more rapidly towards a declining population and share? I mean, for example, it's crystal clear that everybody on the planet can't come close to living the lifestyle of the average American. How do we solve that problem? Are we going to share more? Is the average American happy with his or her lifestyle? To give you an example, when Ann and I first came to Stanford, our daughter was 5 years old, I think, and that was 50 years ago. And even though Stanford salaries were then and continue to be pathetic, Ann was able to stay home with our daughter. She did not have to work. My salary was enough for us to get along on. Nowadays, every professional couple I know, I don't think there's a single exception of the younger ones, feel both have to work in order to get more stuff. And is that good? In other words, Americans work harder now than they did 50 years ago. Is that an advance? Is our course taking us where we want to go? Those are the things we need to be discussing. Is there a way to set up an economy where you can get good stuff, but have lots of leisure at the same time, and not necessarily have five cars to drive in the huge traffic jams?
Yes, I just got a call. There are people asking you to repeat the website.
Oh, it's the usual http://, and then it's just MAHB, Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior is what it stands for, but MAHB.stanford.edu. MAHB.stanford.edu. And you can, if you click on the right place, you can simply get signed up for a newsletter. And an interesting thing about this program is it's truly ground up. Most of the discussion now is what should we be doing and how should we get organized. And everybody can participate. You can't solve the problems of the world by a bunch of relatively well-off old white men telling everybody else what to do. And we really need participation from everywhere. I mean, there's a huge Muslim world out there where the people, I mean, one nice thing is people basically need and want the same sorts of things: a decent diet, a chance for their kids to get educated, ability to practice whatever kind of religion they want to practice, decent housing, decent health care, and so on. And these are things that can unite humanity while we learn to enjoy our differences. But there are tough questions.
Well, let's just take that one. Let's look at that, because that is absolutely true when you look at it. We want food, clothing, shelter, healthy families, our kids taking all of those things that you say are absolutely true. And yet, you know, when you look out around the world, 2 billion people live on less than $1 a day, and another 2 billion on less than $2 a day. And there's some way that we feel we have to keep working at this pace. We can't let go. That the stuff that we need is important, and we don't want to change our lifestyle, or that somehow we would be losing something rather than gaining something. So my question, Paul, about that is, has to do more with the shifting of our worldview and questioning our unexamined beliefs and assumptions. And people don't seem to want to take the time to actually look deeply. Like, even for, you know, this kind of a show to be an hour long is really a long time for people's attention span often, except we have a lot of great listeners who like to hear this. So how do we get people to begin to, it's not about sacrifice, it's about focusing on the things that we want that are common to all of us, and quit focusing on the things that we don't want.
I think it's the opposite of sacrifice, but I think that's That's what we need the discussion of. We need a global discussion of what kind of lives people want to live and what's possible. And again, we've designed the United States around automobiles. So the worst period of my life was when I was a postdoc in Chicago and had to commute somewhere between an hour if I went in the rush hour or 25 minutes if I went outside the rush hour to work. And it ruined my entire life. One of the reasons I've stayed at Stanford is I can walk to work at Stanford, and that's a huge, huge advantage. And we don't ask ourselves these questions enough, and we just accept it when the politicians get on and say, well, the economy's in tough condition, we got to go out and buy more refrigerators, more automobiles, blah, blah, blah. Somebody ought to be saying, do we really need that? Can we redesign society so that a new automobile is not necessary frequently, and find a way to put the automobile workers to doing other things? Would it be better, for example, if we solve some of our unemployment problems by trying to move everybody to a six-hour workday and a five-day work week, something like that? We're a very ingenious species, but one of the problems, in my view, is that we've turned over much too much responsibility to corporations, which Adam Smith didn't like. We had this recent horrendous Supreme Court decision. It tells you who owns the Supreme Court, or at least the people who voted for it, saying that corporations are individuals just like us and should have the right to free speech. Well, if corporations are individuals just like us, can we kill the boards of the tobacco companies who are murdering people all the time? In other words, if you're going to have the rights of corporations to buy votes, just like people are supposed to have that right, I suppose, then they ought to have the responsibilities too. We own the airwaves, and yet we've turned them over to a series of corporations that now define what the mainstream is. The mainstream is pouring us over the cliff, but they get to say, what the mainstream is. Palo Alto's streets are loaded with holes, and we're spending a fortune digging holes in Afghanistan and Iraq entirely, essentially, to get control of fossil fuel flows that we shouldn't be burning. In other words, our invasion of Iraq was as intelligent of if Iraq had a huge supply of cyanide and we were hungry invading Iraq to get the cyanide, because the oil they've got, we can't burn if we're smart.
Yeah, I was talking to, when I was in Copenhagen, I spent some time with George Monbiot, and I thought he put it really simply. He says, it's really easy. We need to quit cutting the trees and stop burning fossil fuel. And one of the things that he said that I learned from him was that if we burned 60% of the already known available fossil fuels, we would be looking at something like a 5 degree centigrade temperature increase.
Well, remember, it isn't just the temperature increase, it's going to change precipitation patterns.
Right.
Our food supply is utterly dependent on precipitation patterns, and people say, well, if the rainfall and the right temperature moves north, then we'll grow corn further north. Yeah, after 50,000 or 100,000 years, when the soils adjust to allow you to grow corn further north, and if you don't have to grow it in Hudson Bay. In other words, we're already marginal, as you pointed out, in our food supply, and we're very busily working to change the weather dramatically in ways that the scientific community can't accurately predict, but every single scientist I know, and I know hundreds of them, is scared witless of the climate disruption thing. And yet the blogs are absolutely full of lies. The Senate is sitting on its hands. One Senator Inhofe actually wants to prosecute scientists who have done their work correctly and are saying what we ought to do.
Yes.
McCarthyism is riding again. It's really scary. I was having lunch today with a very distinguished scientist who just says we're in the middle of the Endarkenment. Slowly but surely we're moving back towards the Dark Ages intellectually, at a time when we desperately need everybody to get together and to deal with these problems.
Let's look at back to your work and science to try to expand our understanding of what we can do. There's a couple areas that I'd like you to talk about that I think relate in a roundabout way. One is ecological intimacy, and the other is coevolution. And we're in this process here. talk about how learning about how we are evolving together and our ecological intimacy could raise our awareness and perhaps allow us to step beyond the broken financial model that we're using, that we need continuous growth on limited resource Earth, and how we can begin to assimilate some of this and put it into a body of ethics that is a global ethic.
Well, of course, one of the crucial things, which is now 50 years old, but which dawned too slowly on the scientific community because the hints of it were in Darwin already, is that when organisms evolved, that is, when we went into the trees to and bushes like tarsiers to start snatching insects, the insects that were getting snatched naturally tried to evolve ways to avoid being eaten by us. In other words, when you have two ecologically intimate kinds of organisms interacting, each is putting a selection pressure on the other, and they either learn, in some sense, evolutionarily learn to get along, or one or the other goes extinct. And the place now we are tending to do our evolution in the so-called co-evolutionary systems. We're doing our adjustment with cultural evolution because our enemies evolve very rapidly genetically. So one of the places where you see this problem rather dramatically is in the fact that now virtually all our antibiotics are ineffective against some organisms, and there are some organisms against which we have essentially no antibiotic defenses anymore. And the reason is that we have not looked at the coevolutionary situation in enough detail and done the things that would have been necessary to keep us armed against the bacteria. So we are getting close to being disarmed. There are some of you have probably heard about MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and so on. There are strains of tuberculosis which we have basically no defenses against anymore. And all of that is because we haven't been teaching evolution in our schools decently. There actually, you probably won't believe this, there are actually people who think you shouldn't teach evolution in schools, even though it's the single most important discipline to know where human beings came from, where we're going, and what we're up against. And we have very similar situations in agriculture. The saddest thing I've seen in some time was a film of an Indian farmer. The agriculture is in deep trouble in various ways in India. Farmers have been committing suicide right and left.
200,000 in the last 3 years.
Yeah, and here's this poor guy walking along, spraying a nasty pesticide covered with it. And the people taking the film said, "Why aren't you protecting yourself?" And he says, "Well, it doesn't kill the bugs anymore, so it can't hurt me." Well, of course, we could become resistant to these pesticides. It would take 95% of the roughly 95% of the people of human beings each generation being killed by the pesticides for a couple hundred years, and then we could be resistant too. It doesn't seem to be the way to go. But our lack of understanding of evolutionary processes, the fact that you can find dozens of websites that'll tell you that people with dark skin are not as smart as people with light skin, which is just simply preposterous. Everybody, every scientist knows that's nonsense, but it's still out there. So we're never mind. I'm starting to rant.
No, but what you're saying is so right, and we haven't really thought. You know, one of the things about antibiotics too that I don't think most people realize, it has so much impacted our water systems.
Not only water systems, but we feed it to our cattle, so that further disarms us from using. I mean, antibiotics are wonderful tools, but they should be used carefully and when they're most necessary, and that involves making some tough decisions. In other words, it's these things are not easy. If you take your child to a doctor with a red ear and 103 fever, from the point of view of society as a whole and the child later on and your grandchildren, the thing to do is to get a swab first, find out if it's a bacterium, and if it's a bacterium, which one, which antibiotic will deal with it best, and that is fine. On the other hand, just taking the antibiotic then will reduce the very, very small chance that the child will die before you get the swab back. And so we've gotten ourselves into lots of positions where what we do is there are different ethical things at different levels.
I just went to a little while back. I had a toothache, and I went to the dentist, and first thing he did was prescribe a heavy dose of the newer strain of antibiotics. And I actually went and got it, and I got home, and I went, what am I doing taking this? And so I looked up essential oils, and it said, oh, you can use Melrose and Thieves.
Yeah.
And so I put a little on, and in 2 days it was completely healed and gone. And we always look to the medical profession now as the first choice rather than the natural world as the place that we should go to first. But we're, again, another example of being so removed from the natural world.
Well, of course, you got to have some pity for the doctors, too, because if you don't give the antibiotic first and then the child gets much sicker or dies, they're likely to be sued. In other words, people go and demand antibiotics. I mean, if I had that kind of situation, I would insist that at the very least that a sample be taken to find out what the bug is, because of course if it's a resistant strain or something, taking the antibiotic is only going to screw up your gut and not deal with the problem. But again, doctors are under all kinds of pressure to get to treat people fast, to spend as little as possible. I mean, you may not believe this, but we live in a nation in which public health, rather than being a government responsibility like it should be, is turned over largely to a series of corporations whose main incentive is to kill you as fast as possible and not treat you. They put more money into paying people to write contracts that make sure you don't get treatment than the highest paid executives would be if we had a national health care system like we ought to. We've had this incredibly stupid debate over this with lots of lies. I mean, when you have people yelling, don't let the government take over my Medicare, you wonder, what chance is there of having a decent discussion of anything in this country?
Let's talk about...
Rant.
I love that you do that. That's great. At least we're not one of the 91% conservative talk shows ranting.
Did you see Glenn Beck saying that he had learned by going... why taxes were really, really bad by going to the public library, which was free? Apparently he's too stupid to even know that the public libraries are supported by taxes.
It's an amazing world we live in. I want to keep coming back to the science, because your book, and I want to make a plug for it again. If you just tuned in, I'm talking to Paul Ehrlich, and his latest book, The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. And, I think about natural selection and what we're doing now. Could it be that... obviously, this is all going to unfold as natural selection. I mean, we may have cockroaches running the planet, but...
Maybe we already do.
They're getting close, I think. Reminds me of an old Bulgakov novel. But, just as an aside, I don't think we talked about the superbugs that are being created with the pesticides that are... Oh, well, that's right. The person didn't kill him.
But it is true that we are disarming ourselves in ways we shouldn't. That is, that there are, again, pesticides are like antibiotics. They are tools that should be used as scalpels, not bludgeons, because our enemies quickly learn to dodge the bludgeons. And,
yep. But one of the things, Paul, that I was thinking of, too, is... There are things happening to us genetically now. The birth rate of males is not only going down, but there are more and more aberrations and birth defects and the inability to have children, or strange things that are happening, particularly in some of the third world countries that are struggling and having many poisons and things. So, just looking at the idea of natural selection, what's your prediction, looking at it from that perspective, of where we're going?
Well, it's interesting that you raised that issue, because when we talk about climate change and climate disruption, it is the sole environmental issue that really is on the front burner. And yet the one you just mentioned is, as are a number of others, possibly more serious and less easy to deal with. For example, you mentioned the increase in female births compared to males. The normal birth ratio in human beings is about 105 males to 100 female sex at birth. And that's because, of course, we're so weak. We tend to die off where the women take over. But in some subarctic villages, it's now 200 girls for every boy. 200 girls for every 100 boys, at 2 to 1.
I thought that was kind of high.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. Well, personally, I wouldn't mind a sex ratio of 200 women to every man, but that's a personal view. Anyway, that's really scary, and one of the things we're doing is releasing a whole lot of toxic chemicals into the environment when we have no clue what they do to us, what their effects are on ecosystems, what kind of selection gradients they're setting up, and we, you know, it's not even just one at a time. We know from a lot of experiments that many toxins synergize. That is, if you have a dose of 10 of one and or 10 of the other, that gives you that, say, a level of 10 of damage. If you get them both together, you get a level of 100 of damage. The classic example is if you smoke and are exposed to asbestos, it's much, much worse than doing either alone, because the smoking kills the system that cleans your lungs, and then the asbestos stays much longer, and your chances of getting mesothelioma are much, much higher. But the way we're toxifying the planet is really scary, because if it really starts killing us off, who knows what you could do about it. These compounds now are spread from pole to pole. We don't know which ones are the most dangerous, and we have no clue about how to get them out of the environment. They're everywhere. You've probably seen the stories. If you analyze people's blood, it turns out looking like a shelf list of an organic chemistry lab.
Yep.
That's not smart. And we should have very different rules on what chemicals we can synthesize and take a chance of releasing into the environment. And that we're running a vast experiment on ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to get sometimes that even if those aren't impacting us, that the importance of diversity in evolution and how, you know, I mean, somebody says, well, the spotted owl, what do I care about the spotted owl or the, you know, whatever is going, but we don't really look at the whole chain and how they're related to the bugs and the earth and the water and the climate system and hydrological system. Can you speak a little bit about the importance of honoring diversity in...
There's an analogy that we've used for years on this, which I think is not perfect, but comes close enough to make the point. Let's suppose you were taking a commuter airliner somewhere, and you walked out on the tarmac to get on board, and you saw a guy on a ladder, and he's prying rivets out of the wing of the plane. And you say, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm prying out the rivets because jerk airlines here can sell each one of them for 75 cents a piece, and it adds to our profits. And you say, well, holy smokes, you know, isn't that dangerous? Oh, no, there's a lot of redundancy built into the way the plane's riveted together, so they're not going to miss a few rivets. Well, the answer, of course, is that, yes, redundancy is built into aircraft. There are limits to how much you can put in because of weight limitations and so on, but the airplane designers try and do that. On the other hand, you don't know whether the plane's going to run into a thunderstorm, what's going to happen that day, what each rivet does, and it's intrinsically moronic to just keep pulling the rivets out and assuming the airplane's going to continue to function safely. And it's exactly the same thing with spotted owls or butterflies or this flower or that flower. We know enough to know that many of them play essential roles. We know enough to know that, for example, as we disturb the climate, that the roles played are going to shift around. That is, a tree that may be very important to carbon storage now and helping to keep the climate from changing too rapidly may tend to die out under new conditions, and the one that replaces it be nowhere near as effective at doing the things that trees do for us. And so it's just crazy to say, what should I care about the spotted owl, just as it would be crazy to say, what should I care about how many rivets there are in the wing of my airliner when I fly someplace? You better care. You better not fly in an airline that randomly removes rivets from the wing. And what you're doing right now is flying on a spaceship that's randomly removing rivets from its operating systems.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that you were talking about, the nay in China, and it made me begin to think, you didn't get into it too much, but of course they're a matrilineal culture. And I don't know, 7,000, 6,000 years ago, we had a lot more matrilineal cultures around. And obviously the UN and the body of scientists that I listen to all say that one of the things that's important to turn things around is the empowerment of women. Can you talk a little bit about that from a co-evolutionary scientific perspective in terms of evolution?
Well, look, first of all, the data are impressive that if you give women job opportunities, if you give women education around the world, they are behind the eight ball on literacy, for example. If you give them the power to control their reproduction, that is, if everybody who's sexually active has access to contraceptives and, if necessary, backup abortion, then you do a number of things that are really important. First of all, you take advantage. You know, we have all kinds of problems to solve. Cutting half of humanity out of that opportunity is really dumb. We're doing better. One of the nice things, I say something positive, since the Second World War, we've done a lot to improve the status of women, particularly in countries like the United States. On the other hand, we've gone nowhere near far enough. Even in countries like Sweden and China, women still don't get the full rights they ought to have. So that's one thing. The second thing is that when you give women rights, birth rates go down. And if there's anything that's crystal clear to every scientist, it is that we can't support even 7 billion people in the style that Americans are accustomed to, and that it's absolutely crucial if we're going to have a chance to start reducing the size of the population. And the easiest and, in my view, the best way to do that is to give more power to women. Again, they have fewer children if they're well-educated and have job opportunities, and that is going to give us a chance. The one of the silly things in our society, but again, it's part of that culture gap, is that people think that the beaver-cleaver family is the typical human family arrangement. And in fact, the idea that you have a man who's a breadwinner, a woman who's subservient to him and just raises two or three children, or four or five children, is the typical human system is just nonsense. It's from a very short time period, in fact, probably less than a decade after the Second World War, when that sort of thing was common. The nay are an extreme example where there are no husbands at all, where the only function men play in families, basically, is producing the children. But the children are then raised by the uncle, not by the inseminator. So, and of course, if you go back to the Bible, what was the system then? It was men controlling a lot of women. The biblical system is polygyny, or more technically, polygyny. So we don't think enough about the roles that people play in our societies or should play, and one of the big places where we should be doing better here and elsewhere is in giving more power and more rights to women. We've moved in that direction, but we haven't gone far enough.
Yeah. Well, Paul, we're coming close to the end of the hour here, and I'd like to, first of all, thank you very much for being on the show.
But
My pleasure. I'd like you to tell us what gives you hope. You know, you've been at this for almost five decades, I think, at least.
It started when I was three.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And so did I. And, you know, but you're still going. So
Well, I both have incentive and hope. The incentive is I'm now sleeping with a great grandmother, if you could believe that.
Wow.
So I have a great granddaughter who's wonderful.
Mm.
And I have grandchildren, and I have a child, and many of my younger colleagues have children that I'm one level or another bonded to, and I think all of us should do everything we can to give those kids and their generation a chance. And what gives me hope that we can is that we know, we don't understand why, but we know that human societies can change very, very rapidly when the time is ripe. For example, when I was a young kid, when I was 7 or 8, lynchings were common in the southern United States. A woman, if she wanted to have a career, could be a grade school teacher, a nurse, or a secretary. That was pretty much it. If you had a dark skin, you never appeared in the movies except as a janitor. The only sport, if you had a dark skin that you could engage in, was boxing, and that was tough. And then along came the Second World War, and a lot of things changed. They found out that women could actually rivet airplanes together, and they found out that people with dark skins could be fighter pilots. And quite rapidly after the Second World War, you know, the role of women and the desegregation movement got going. It hasn't gone far enough, but in historic terms, in, say, between 1955 and 1975, the world changed dramatically and has continued to change in that direction. I mean, after all, I now fly on airliners. I did my instrument training with a woman, and I now fly on airliners where women are often captains, and that's terrific. And we have entire TV shows which feature people with dark skins, and curiously enough, they seem to be able to do okay in sports as well. So we can see dramatic change. And the one that's most dramatic, I think, for people that are a lot younger than I am, is the disappearance of the Soviet Union, which shows when the time is ripe, our societies can change very dramatically, which makes me hope that in terms of how we treat each other and how we treat our environment, that kind of change is still possible when the time is ripe. And I think the job for all of us is to do the best we can to ripen the time as fast as we can.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, I just want to thank you very much for all our listeners for your tireless work from the population bomb to dominant animal and beyond. You've been informing, inspiring, and activating us all, and it's just an honor to have you on Conversations.
Well, it's been my great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Take care. We'll talk
soon.
Bye-bye. Paul Ehrlich, yes, one of the greats. Next week, we have an upcoming show with a really amazing woman. Her name is Jan Chosen-Bays. She's an MD and a Roshi, and she has a book out called Mindful Eating. She studied and practiced Zen Buddhism since 1973 and received her priest's ordination in 1979 from Tizan Mazumi. Roshi Chosen is particularly involved in teaching people how to use meditation to work with eating disorders and grief. So stay tuned next week. If you didn't get to hear all of this interview, you can go to www.arewelistening.net. Also, I want to tell you that if you didn't know, I'm going with a group of people from Nevada County to Bolivia to the first ever People's Conference on Climate Change and Mother Earth Rights. Promises to be a real switch from Copenhagen. I'll be reporting back on the news from Cochabamba with Robin Milam. And so I hope you'll stay tuned for that. And also on March 13th, we are having a fundraiser with all kinds of amazing trips and dinners and massages and artwork and jewelry and all kinds of things. So please come to St. Joseph's from 7 to 10. That's the Saturday, the 13th of March. If you need more information, give me a call, 477-7757. So it's just about time for me to be out of here. And I want to thank our supporters, including you, but also Sacramento Natural Food Co-op, presenting the class Knife Skills, wherein participants learn how to prepare vegetables, bone out chicken breasts, and more. Thursday, March 4th, 6 p.m., complete class schedule at sacfoodcoop.com. So until next week, be well, keep the faith, And remember, you make a difference. Thanks for listening to Conversations on KVMR 89.5 FM and Truckee 105.1 FM, translator K286 AN. Bye for now.
The earth is a mother. We must take care of her. The earth is a mother. We must take care of her. Her sacred ground we walk upon. With every step we take, her sacred ground we walk upon. With every step we take, with every step we take.
Coming right up is Tom Myers with So Many Roads, 4 o'clock Music Magazine, Elisa Parker, 6 p.m. KVMR Evening News with Paul Emery and Gang, 7 o'clock Democracy Now!, 8 o'clock The Other Side with Julia Bournakis Harper, 10 o'clock The Funk Hole with Todd Wahlsee.